many suitors for the princess whose inability to cure her cost them their lives. Now it happened that after things had been going on in this way for some time, the nurse's son, Marzavan, returned from his travels. He had been in many countries and learnt many things, including astrology. Needless to say that one of the first things his mother told him was the sad condition of the princess, his foster sister. Marzavan asked if she could not manage to let him see the princess without the king's knowledge. After some consideration, his mother consented, and even persuaded the eunuch on guard to make no objection to Marzavan's entering the royal apartment. The princess was delighted to see her foster brother again, and after some conversation, she confided to him all her history and the cause of her imprisonment. Marzavan listened with downcast eyes and the utmost attention. When she had finished speaking, he said,
"If what you tell me, princess, is indeed the case, I do not despair of finding comfort for you. Take patience yet a little longer. I will set out at once to explore other countries, and when you hear of my return, be sure that he for whom you sigh is not far off."
So saying, he took his leave and started next morning on his travels. Marzavan journeyed from city to city, and from one island and province to another. And wherever he went, he heard people talk of the strange story of the Princess Badoura, as the Princess of China was named. After 4 months, he reached a large, populous seaport town named Torf. And here he heard no more of the Princess Badoura, but a great deal of Prince Kamaralzaman, who was reported ill, and whose story sounded very similar to that of the Princess Badoura. Marzavan was rejoiced, and set out at once for Prince Kamaralzaman's residence. The ship on which he embarked had a prosperous voyage till she got within sight of the capital of King Shahzaman, but when just about to enter the harbor, she suddenly struck on a rock, and foundered within sight of the palace where the prince was living with his father and the grand vizier. Marzavan, who swam well, threw himself into the sea and managed to land close to the palace, where he was kindly received, and after having a change of clothing given him, was brought before the grand vizier. The vizier was at once attracted by the young man's superior air and intelligent conversation, and perceiving that he had gained much experience in the course of his travels, he said,
"Ah, how I wish you had learned some secret which might enable you to cure a malady which has plunged this court into affliction for some time past."
Marzavan replied that if he knew what the illness was, he might possibly be able to suggest a remedy, on which the vizier related to him the whole history of Prince Kamaralzaman. On hearing this, Marzavan rejoiced inwardly, for he felt sure that he had at last discovered the object of the Princess Badoura's infatuation. However, he said nothing, but begged to be allowed to see the prince. On entering the royal apartment, the first thing which struck him was the prince himself, who lay stretched out on his bed with his eyes closed. The king sat near him, but, without paying any regard to his presence, Marzavan exclaimed,
"Heavens, what a striking likeness!"
And indeed, there was a good deal of resemblance between the features of Kamaralzaman and those of the Princess of China. These words caused the prince to open his eyes with languid curiosity, and Marzavan seized this moment to pay him his compliments, contriving at the same time to express the condition of the Princess of China in terms unintelligible, indeed, to the Sultan and his vizier, but which left the prince in no doubt that his visitor could give him some welcome information. The prince begged his father to allow him the favor of a private interview with Marzavan, and the king was only too pleased to find his son taking an interest in anyone or anything. As soon as they were left alone, Marzavan told the prince the story of the Princess Badoura and her sufferings, adding,
"I am convinced that you alone can cure her, but before starting on so long a journey, you must be well and strong, so do your best to recover as quickly as may be."
These words produced a great effect on the prince, who was so much cheered by the hopes held out that he declared he felt able to get up and be dressed. The king was overjoyed at the result of Marzavan's interview and ordered public rejoicings in honor of the prince's recovering. Before long, the prince was quite restored to his original state of health, and as soon as he felt himself really strong, he took Marzavan aside and said,
Now is the time to perform your promise. I am so impatient to see my beloved princess once more that I am sure I shall fall ill again if we do not start soon. The one obstacle is my father's tender care of me, for, as you may have noticed, he cannot bear me out of his sight.
Prince, replied Marzavan, I have already thought over the matter, and this is what seems to me the best plan. You have not been out of doors since my arrival. Ask the king's permission to go with me for 2 or 3 days hunting, and when he has given leave, order 2 good horses to be held ready for each of us. Leave all the rest to me.
Next day the prince seized a favorable opportunity for making his request, and the king gladly granted it on condition that only 1 night should be spent out for fear of too great fatigue after such a long illness. Next morning Prince Kamaralzaman and Marzavan were off betimes, attended by 2 grooms leading the 2 extra horses. They hunted a little by the way, but took care to get as far from the towns as possible. At nightfall they reached an inn, where they supped and slept till midnight. Then Marzavan awoke and roused the prince without disturbing anyone else. He begged the prince to give him the coat he had been wearing, and to put on another which they had brought with them. They mounted their 2nd horses, and Marzavan led 1 of the groom's horses by the bridle. By daybreak our travelers found themselves where 4 crossroads met in the middle of the forest. Here Marzavan begged the prince to wait for him, and leading the groom's horse into a dense part of the wood, he cut its throat, dipped the prince's coat in its blood, and having rejoined the prince, threw the coat on the ground where the roads parted. In answer to Kamaralzaman's inquiries as to the reason for this, Marzavan replied that the only chance they had of continuing their journey was to divert attention by creating the idea of the prince's death.
Your father will doubtless be plunged in the deepest grief,
he went on,
but his joy at your return will be all the greater.
The prince and his companion now continued their journey by land and sea, and as they had brought plenty of money to defray their expenses, they met with no needless delays. At length they reached the capital of China, where they spent 3 days in a suitable lodging to recover from their fatigues. During this time Marzavan had an astrologer's dress prepared for the prince. Then they went to the baths, after which the prince put on the astrologer's robe and was conducted within sight of the king's palace by Marzavan, who left him there and went to consult his mother, the princess's nurse. Meantime the prince, according to Marzavan's instructions, advanced close to the palace gates and there proclaimed aloud,
I am an astrologer, and I come to restore health to the Princess Badoura, daughter of the high and mighty King of China, on the condition laid down by His Majesty of marrying her should I succeed, or of losing my life if I fail.
It was some little time since anyone had presented himself to run the terrible risk involved in attempting to cure the princess, and a crowd soon gathered round the prince. On perceiving his youth, good looks, and distinguished bearing, everyone felt pity for him.
What are you thinking of, sir?
Exclaimed some.
Why expose yourself to certain death?
Are not the heads you see exposed on the town wall sufficient warning?
For mercy's sake, give up this mad idea and retire whilst you can.
But the prince remained firm, and only repeated his cry with greater assurance to the horror of the crowd.
He is resolved to die, they cried. May heaven have pity on him.
Kamaralzaman now called out for the 3rd time, and at last the Grand Vizier himself came out and fetched him in. The Prime Minister led the prince to the king, who was much struck by the noble air of this new adventurer, and felt such pity for the fate so evidently in store for him that he tried to persuade the young man to renounce his project. But Kamaralzaman politely yet firmly persisted in his intentions, and at length the king desired the eunuch who had the guard of the princess's apartments to conduct the astrologer to her presence. The eunuch led the way through long passages, and Kamaralzaman followed rapidly, in haste to reach the object of his desires. At last they came to a large hall, which was the anteroom to the princess's chamber, and here Kamaralzaman said to the eunuch,
Now you shall choose. Shall I cure the princess in her presence,
or shall I do it from here without seeing her?
The eunuch, who had expressed many contemptuous doubts as they came along of the newcomer's powers, was much surprised and said,
If you really can cure, it is immaterial when you do it. Your fame will be equally great.
Very well, replied the prince. Then, impatient though I am to see the princess, I will effect the cure where I stand, the better to convince you of my power.
He accordingly drew out his writing case and wrote as follows.
Adorable princess, the enamored Camaralzaman has never forgotten the moment when, contemplating your sleeping beauty, he gave you his heart. As he was at that time deprived of the happiness of conversing with you, he ventured to give you his ring as a token of his love, and to take yours in exchange, which he now encloses in this letter. Should you deign to return it to him, he will be the happiest of mortals. If not, he will cheerfully resign himself to death, seeing he does so for love of you. He awaits your reply in your anteroom.
Having finished this note, the prince carefully enclosed the ring in it without letting the eunuch see it, and gave him the letter, saying,
Take this to your mistress, my friend, and if on reading it and seeing its contents she is not instantly cured, you may call me an impudent impostor.
The eunuch at once passed into the princess's room, and handing her the letter, said,
Madam, a new astrologer has arrived who declares that you will be cured as soon as you have read this letter and seen what it contains.
The princess took the note and opened it with languid indifference. But no sooner did she see her ring than, barely glancing at the writing, she rose hastily, and with one bound reached the doorway and pushed back the hangings. Here she and the prince recognized each other, and in a moment they were locked in each other's arms, where they tenderly embraced, wondering how they came to meet at last after so long a separation. The nurse, who had hastened after her charge, drew them back to the inner room, where the princess restored her ring to Camaralzaman.
Take it back, she said. I could not keep it without returning yours to you, and I am resolved to wear that as long as I live.
Meantime, the eunuch had hastened back to the king.
Sire, he cried, all the former doctors and astrologers were mere quacks. This man has cured the princess without even seeing her.
He then told all to the king, who, overjoyed, hastened to his daughter's apartments, where, after embracing her, he placed her hand in that of the prince, saying,
Happy stranger, I keep my promise and give you my daughter to wife, be you who you may. But, if I am not much mistaken, your condition is above what you appear to be.
The prince thanked the king in the warmest and most respectful terms and added,
As regards to my person, your majesty has rightly guessed that I am not an astrologer. It is but a disguise, which I assumed in order to merit your illustrious alliance. I am myself a prince. My name is Camaralzaman, and my father is Shazaman, king of the Isle of the Children of Caledan.
He then told his whole history, including the extraordinary manner of his first seeing and loving the Princess Badoura. When he had finished, the king exclaimed,
So remarkable a story must not be lost to posterity. It shall be inscribed in the archives of my kingdom and published everywhere abroad.
The wedding took place next day amidst great pomp and rejoicings. Marzavan was not forgotten, but was given a lucrative post at court, with a promise of further advancement. The prince and princess were now entirely happy, and months slipped by unconsciously in the enjoyment of each other's society. One night, however, Prince Camaralzaman dreamt that he saw his father lying at the point of death, and saying,
Alas, my son, whom I loved so tenderly, has deserted me, and is now causing my death.
The prince woke with such a groan as to startle the princess, who asked what was the matter.
Ah! Cried the prince, at this very moment my father is perhaps no more.
And he told his dream. The princess said but little at the time, but next morning she went to the king, and kissing his hand, said,
I have a favor to ask of your majesty, and I beg you to believe that it is in no way prompted by my husband. It is that you will allow us both to visit my father-in-law, King Shahzaman."
Sorry though the king felt at the idea of parting with his daughter, he felt her request to be so reasonable that he could not refuse it, and made but one condition, which was that she should only spend 1 year at the court of King Shahzaman, suggesting that in future the young couple should visit their respective parents alternately. The princess brought this good news to her husband, who thanked her tenderly for this fresh proof of her affection. All preparations for the journey were now pressed forwards, and when all was ready, the king accompanied the travelers for some days, after which he took an affectionate leave of his daughter, and charging the prince to take every care of her, returned to his capital. The prince and princess journeyed on, and at the end of a month reached a huge meadow interspersed with clumps of big trees, which cast a most pleasant shade. As the heat was great, Kamar al-Zaman thought it well to encamp in this cool spot. Accordingly, the tents were pitched, and the princess, entering hers whilst the prince was giving his further orders, removed her girdle, which she placed beside her, and desiring her women to leave her, lay down and was soon asleep. When the camp was all in order, the prince entered the tent, and, seeing the princess asleep, he sat down near her without speaking. His eyes fell on the girdle, which he took up, and whilst inspecting the precious stones set in it, he noticed a little pouch sewn to the girdle and fastened by a loop. He touched it and felt something hard within. Curious as to what this might be, he opened the pouch and found a carnelian engraved with various figures and strange characters.
"This carnelian must be something very precious," thought he, "or my wife would not wear it on her person with so much care."
In truth, it was a talisman which the Queen of China had given her daughter, telling her it would ensure her happiness as long as she carried it about her. The better to examine the stone, the prince stepped to the open doorway of the tent. As he stood there holding it in the open palm of his hand, a bird suddenly swooped down, picking the stone up in its beak, and flew away with it. Imagine the prince's dismay at losing a thing by which his wife evidently set such store. The bird, having secured its prey, flew off some yards and alighted on the ground, holding the talisman in its beak. Prince Kamar al-Zaman advanced, hoping the bird would drop it. But as soon as he approached, the thief fluttered on a little further still. He continued his pursuit till the bird suddenly swallowed the stone and took a longer flight than before. The prince then hoped to kill it with a stone, but the more hotly he pursued, the further flew the bird. In this fashion he was led on by hill and dale through the entire day, and when night came, the tiresome creature roosted on the top of a very high tree where it could rest in safety. The prince, in despair at all his useless trouble, began to think whether he had better return to the camp.
"But," thought he, "how shall I find my way back? Must I go uphill or down? I should certainly lose my way in the dark, even if my strength held out."
Overwhelmed by hunger, thirst, fatigue, and sleep, he ended by spending the night at the foot of the tree. Next morning, Kamar al-Zaman woke up before the bird left its perch, and no sooner did it take flight than he followed it again, with as little success as the previous day, only stopping to eat some herbs and fruit he found by the way. In this fashion he spent 10 days, following the bird all day and spending the night at the foot of a tree, whilst it roosted on the topmost bough. On the 11th day, the bird and the prince reached a large town, and as soon as they were close to its walls, the bird took a sudden and higher flight and was shortly completely out of sight, while Kamar al-Zaman felt in despair at having to give up all hopes of ever recovering the talisman of the Princess Badoura. Much cast down, he entered the town, which was built near the sea and had a fine harbor. He walked about the streets for a long time, not knowing where to go, but at length, as he walked near the seashore, he found a garden door open and walked in. The gardener, a good old man, who was at work, happened to look up, and, seeing a stranger, whom he recognized by his dress as a Musulman, he told him to come in at once and to shut the door. Qamar al-Zaman did as he was bid and inquired why this precaution was taken.
"Because," said the gardener, "I see that you are a stranger and a Musulman, and this town is almost entirely inhabited by idolaters who hate and persecute all of our faith. It seems almost a miracle that has led you to this house, and I am indeed glad that you have found a place of safety."
Qamar al-Zaman warmly thanked the kind old man for offering him shelter and was about to say more, but the gardener interrupted him with,
"Leave compliments alone. You are weary and must be hungry. Come in, eat, and rest."
So saying, he led the prince into his cottage, and after satisfying his hunger, begged to learn the cause of his arrival. Qamar al-Zaman told him all without disguise, and ended by inquiring the shortest way to his father's capital.
"For," added he, "if I try to rejoin the princess, how should I find her after 11 days' separation? Perhaps, indeed, she may no longer be alive."
At this terrible thought, he burst into tears. The gardener informed Qamar al-Zaman that they were quite a year's land journey to any Mohammedan country, but that there was a much shorter route by sea to the Ebony Island, from whence the Isle of the Children of Caladan could be easily reached, and that a ship sailed once a year for the Ebony Island by which he might get so far as his very home.
"If only you had arrived a few days sooner," he said, "you might have embarked at once. As it is, you must now wait till next year. But if you care to stay with me, I offer you my house, such as it is, with all my heart."
Prince Qamar al-Zaman thought himself lucky to find some place of refuge, and gladly accepted the gardener's offer. He spent his days working in the garden, and his nights thinking of and sighing for his beloved wife. Let us now see what had become during this time of the Princess Badoura. On first waking, she was much surprised not to find the prince near her. She called her women and asked if they knew where he was, and whilst they were telling her that they had seen him enter the tent, but had not noticed his leaving it, she took up her belt and perceived that the little pouch was open and the talisman gone. She at once concluded that her husband had taken it and would shortly bring it back. She waited for him till evening rather impatiently, and wondering what could have kept him from her so long. When night came without him, she felt in despair, and abused the talisman and its marker roundly. In spite of her grief and anxiety, however, she did not lose her presence of mind, but decided on a courageous, though very unusual, step. Only the princess and her women knew of Qamar al-Zaman's disappearance, for the rest of the party were sleeping or resting in their tents. Fearing some treason should the truth be known, she ordered her women not to say a word which would give rise to any suspicion, and proceeded to change her dress for one of her husband's, to whom, as has already been said, she bore a strong likeness. In this disguise she looked so like the prince that when she gave orders next morning to break up the camp and continue the journey, no one suspected the change. She made one of her women enter her litter, whilst she herself mounted on horseback, and the march began. After a protracted journey by land and sea, the princess, still under the name and disguise of Prince Qamar al-Zaman, arrived at the capital of the Ebony Island, whose king was named Armanos. No sooner did the king hear that the ship which was just in port had on board the son of his old friend and ally, than he hurried to meet the supposed prince, and had him and his retinue brought to the palace, where they were lodged and entertained sumptuously. After 3 days, finding that his guest, to whom he had taken a great fancy, talked of continuing his journey, King Armanos said to him,
"Prince, I am now an old man, and unfortunately I have no son to whom to leave my kingdom. It has pleased heaven to give me only one daughter, who possesses such great beauty and charm that I could only give her to a prince as highly born and as accomplished as yourself. Instead, therefore, of returning to your own country, take my daughter and my crown, and stay with us. I shall feel that I have a worthy successor, and shall cheerfully retire from the fatigues of government."
The king's offer was naturally rather embarrassing to the Princess Badoura. She felt that it was equally impossible to confess that she had deceived him, or to refuse the marriage on which he had set his heart. A refusal which might turn all his kindness to hatred and persecution. All things considered, she decided to accept, and after a few moments' silence said with a blush, which the king attributed to modesty,
"Sire, I feel so great an obligation for the good opinion your majesty has expressed for my person, and of the honor you do me, that though I am quite unworthy of it, I dare not refuse. But, sire, I can only accept such an alliance if you give me your promise to assist me with your counsels."
The marriage being thus arranged, the ceremony was fixed for the following day, and the princess employed the intervening time in informing the officers of her suite of what had happened, assuring them that the Princess Badoura had given her full consent to the marriage. She also told her women and bade them keep her secret well. King Armanos, delighted with the success of his plans, lost no time in assembling his court and council, to whom he presented his successor, and placing his future son-in-law on the throne, made everyone do homage and take oaths of allegiance to the new king. At night, the whole town was filled with rejoicings, and with much pomp, the Princess Hayatelnefis, this was the name of the king's daughter, was conducted to the palace of the Princess Badoura. Now Badoura had thought much of the difficulties of her first interview with King Armanos's daughter, and she felt the only thing to do was at once to take her into her confidence. Accordingly, as soon as they were alone, she took Hayatelnefis by the hand and said,
"Princess, I have a secret to tell you, and must throw myself on your mercy. I am not Prince Kamaralzaman, but a princess like yourself, and his wife, and I beg you to listen to my story. Then I am sure you will forgive my imposture, in consideration of my sufferings."
She then related her whole history, and at its close, Hayatelnefis embraced her warmly and assured her of her entire sympathy and affection. The two princesses now planned out their future action and agreed to combine to keep up the deception and to let Badoura continue to play a man's part until such time as there might be news of the real Kamaralzaman. Whilst these things were passing in the Ebony Island, Prince Kamaralzaman continued to find shelter in the gardener's cottage in the town of the idolaters. Early one morning, the gardener said to the prince,
"Today is a public holiday, and the people of the town not only do not work themselves, but forbid others to do so. You had better, therefore, take a good rest, whilst I go to see some friends, and as the time is near for the arrival of the ship of which I told you, I will make inquiries about it, and try to bespeak a passage for you."
He then put on his best clothes and went out, leaving the prince, who strolled into the garden and was soon lost in thoughts of his dear wife and their sad separation. As he walked up and down, he was suddenly disturbed in his reverie by the noise two large birds were making in a tree. Kamaralzaman stood still and looked up, and saw that the birds were fighting so savagely with beaks and claws that before long one fell dead to the ground, whilst the conqueror spread his wings and flew away. Almost immediately, two other larger birds, who had been watching the duel, flew up and alighted, one at the head and the other at the feet of the dead bird. They stood there some time sadly shaking their heads, and then dug up a grave with their claws in which they buried him. As soon as they had filled in the grave, the two flew off, and ere long returned, bringing with them the murderer, whom they held, one by a wing and the other by a leg with their beaks, screaming and struggling with rage and terror. But they held tight, and having brought him to his victim's grave, they proceeded to kill him, after which they tore open his body, scattered the inside, and once more flew away. The prince, who had watched the whole scene with much interest, now drew near the spot where it happened, and glancing at the dead bird, he noticed something red lying near, which had evidently fallen out of its inside. He picked it up, and what was his surprise when he recognized the Princess Badoura's talisman, which had been the cause of many misfortunes. It would be impossible to describe his joy. He kissed the talisman repeatedly, wrapped it up, and carefully tied it round his arm. For the first time since his separation from the princess, he had a good night. And next morning, he was up at daybreak, and went cheerfully to ask what work he should do. The gardener told him to cut down an old fruit tree which had quite died away, and Kamar al-Zaman took an axe and fell to vigorously. As he was hacking at one of the roots, the axe struck on something hard. On pushing away the earth, he discovered a large slab of bronze, under which was disclosed a staircase with 10 steps. He went down them and found himself in a roomy kind of cave in which stood 50 large bronze jars, each with a cover on it. The prince uncovered one after another and found them all filled with gold dust. Delighted with his discovery, he left the cave, replaced the slab, and having finished cutting down the tree, waited for the gardener's return. The gardener had heard the night before that the ship about which he was inquiring would start ere long, but the exact date not being yet known, he had been told to return next day for further information. He had gone, therefore, to inquire, and came back with good news, beaming in his face.
"My son," said he, "rejoice and hold yourself ready to start in 3 days' time. The ship is to set sail, and I have arranged all about your passage with the captain."
"You could not bring me better news," replied Kamar al-Zaman, "and in return I have something pleasant to tell you. Follow me, and see the good fortune which has befallen you."
He then led the gardener to the cave, and having shown him the treasure stored up there, said how happy it made him that heaven should in this way reward his kind host's many virtues, and compensate him for the privations of many years.
"What do you mean?"
asked the gardener.
"Do you imagine that I should appropriate this treasure? It is yours, and I have no right whatever to it. For the last 80 years, I have dug up the ground here without discovering anything. It is clear that these riches are intended for you, and they are much more needed by a prince like yourself than by an old man like me, who am near my end and require nothing. This treasure comes just at the right time, when you are about to return to your own country, where you will make good use of it."
But the prince would not hear of this suggestion, and finally, after much discussion, they agreed to divide the gold. When this was done, the gardener said,
"My son, the great thing now is to arrange how you can best carry off this treasure as secretly as possible, for fear of losing it. There are no olives in the Ebony Island, and those imported from here fetch a high price. As you know, I have a good stock of the olives which grew in this garden. Now you must take 50 jars, fill each half full of gold dust, and fill them up with the olives. We will then have them take on board ship when you embark."
The prince took this advice, and spent the rest of the day filling the 50 jars, and fearing lest the precious talisman might slip from his arm and be lost again, he took the precaution of putting it in one of the jars, on which he made a mark, so as to be able to recognize it. When night came, the jars were all ready, and the prince and his host went to bed. Whether in consequence of his great age or of the fatigues and excitement of the previous day, I do not know, but the gardener passed a very bad night. He was worse next day, and by the morning of the 3rd day, was dangerously ill. At daybreak, the ship's captain and some of his sailors knocked at the gardener door and asked for the passenger who was to embark.
"I am he," said Kamar al-Zaman, who had opened the door. "The gardener who took my passage is ill and cannot see you, but please come in and take these jars of olives and my bag, and I will follow as soon as I have taken leave of him."
The sailors did as he asked, and the captain, before leaving, charged Kamar al-Zaman to lose no time, as the wind was fair, and he wished to set sail at once. As soon as they were gone, the prince returned to the cottage to bid farewell to his old friend, and to thank him once more for all his kindness. But the old man was at his last gasp, and had barely murmured his confession of faith when he expired. Kamar al-Zaman was obliged to stay and pay him the last offices, so having dug a grave in the garden, he wrapped the kind old man up and buried him. He then locked the door, gave up the key to the owner of the garden, and hurried to the quay, only to hear that the ship had sailed long ago, after waiting 3 hours for him. It may well be believed that the prince felt in despair at this fresh misfortune, which obliged him to spend another year in a strange and distasteful country. Moreover, he had once more lost the Princess Badoura's talisman, which he feared he might never see again. There was nothing left for him but to hire the garden, as the old man had done, and to live on in the cottage. As he could not well cultivate the garden by himself, he engaged a lad to help him, and to secure the rest of the treasure, he put the remaining gold dust into 50 more jars, filling them up with olives so as to have them ready for transport. Whilst the prince was settling down to this second year of toil and privation, the ship made a rapid voyage and arrived safely at the Ebony Island. As the palace of the new king, or rather of the Princess Badoura, overlooked the harbor, she saw the ship entering it and asked what vessel it was coming in so gaily decked with flags, and was told that it was a ship from the Island of the Idolaters which yearly brought rich merchandise. The princess, ever on the lookout for any chance of news of her beloved husband, went down to the harbor attended by some officers of the court, and arrived just as the captain was landing. She sent for him and asked many questions as to his country, voyage, what passengers he had, and what his vessel was laden with. The captain answered all her questions, and said that his passengers consisted entirely of traders who brought rich stuffs from various countries, fine muslins, precious stones, musk, amber, spices, drugs, olives, and many other things. As soon as he mentioned olives, the princess, who was very partial to them, exclaimed, "I will take all you have on board. Have them unloaded, and we will make our bargain at once. And tell the other merchants to let me see all their best wares before showing them to other people."
"Sire," replied the captain, "I have on board 50 very large pots of olives. They belong to a merchant who was left behind, as in spite of waiting for him he delayed so long that I was obliged to set sail without him."
"Never mind," said the princess, "unload them all the same, and we will arrange the price."
The captain accordingly sent his boat off to the ship, and it soon returned laden with the 50 pots of olives. The princess asked what they might be worth.
"Sire," replied the captain, "the merchant is very poor. Your majesty will not overpay him if you give him 1,000 pieces of silver."
"In order to satisfy him, as he is so poor," said the princess, "I will order 1,000 pieces of gold to be given you, which you will be sure to remit to him."
So saying, she gave orders for the payment, and returned to the palace, having the jars carried before her. When evening came, the Princess Badoura retired to the inner part of the palace, and going to the apartments of the Princess Hayat al-Nefis, she had the 50 jars of olives brought to her. She opened one to let her friend taste the olives, and to taste them herself. But great was her surprise when, on pouring some into a dish, she found them all powdered with gold dust.
"What an adventure! How extraordinary!" she cried.
Then she had the other jars opened, and was more and more surprised to find the olives in each jar mixed with gold dust. But when at length her talisman was discovered in one of the jars, her emotion was so great that she fainted away. The Princess Hayat al-Nefis and her women hastened to restore her, and as soon as she recovered consciousness, she covered the precious talisman with kisses. Then, dismissing the attendants, she said to her friend,
"You will have guessed, my dear, that it was the sight of this talisman which has moved me so deeply. This was the cause of my separation from my dear husband, and now I am convinced it will be the means of our reunion."
As soon as it was light next day, the Princess Badoura sent for the captain and made further inquiries about the merchant who owned the olive jars she had bought. In reply, the captain told her all he knew of the place where the young man lived, and how, after engaging his passage, he came to be left behind.
"If that is the case," said the princess, "you must set sail at once, and go back for him. He is a debtor of mine, and must be brought here at once, or I will confiscate all your merchandise. I shall now give orders to have all the warehouses where your cargo is placed under the royal seal, and they will only be opened when you have brought me the man I ask for. Go at once, and obey my orders."
The captain had no choice but to do as he was bid, So hastily provisioning his ship, he started that same evening on his return voyage. When, after a rapid passage, he gained sight of the island of idolaters, he judged it better not to enter the harbor, but casting anchor at some distance, he embarked at night in a small boat with 6 active sailors and landed near Camaralzaman's cottage. The prince was not asleep, and as he lay awake moaning over all the sad events which had separated him from his wife, he thought he heard a knock at the garden door. He went to open it, and was immediately seized by the captain and sailors, who without a word of explanation forcibly bore him off to the boat, which took them back to the ship without loss of time. No sooner were they on board than they weighed anchor and set sail. Camaralzaman, who had kept silence till then, now asked the captain, whom he had recognized, the reason for this abduction.
"Are you not a debtor of the king of the Ebony Island?" asked the captain. "I? Why, I never even heard of him before, and never set foot in his kingdom," was the answer. "Well, you must know better than I," said the captain. "You will soon see him now, and meantime be content where you are, and have patience."
The return voyage was as prosperous as the former one, and though it was night when the ship entered the harbor, the captain lost no time in landing with his passenger, whom he conducted to the palace, where he begged an audience with the king. Directly the Princess Badoura saw the prince, she recognized him in spite of his shabby clothes. She longed to throw herself on his neck, but restrained herself, feeling it was better for them both that she should play her part a little longer. She therefore desired one of her officers to take care of him and to treat him well. Next she ordered another officer to remove the seals from the warehouse, whilst she presented the captain with a costly diamond, and told him to keep the 1,000 pieces of gold paid for the olives, as she would arrange matters with the merchant himself. She then returned to her private apartments, where she told the Princess Hayatel Nefes all that had happened, as well as her plans for the future, and begged her assistance, which her friend readily promised. Next morning she ordered the prince to be taken to the bath, and clothed in a manner suitable to an emir or governor of a province. He was then introduced to the council, where his good looks and grand air drew the attention of all on him. Princess Badoura, delighted to see him looking himself once more, turned to the other emirs, saying,
"My lords, I introduce to you a new colleague, Camaralzaman, whom I have known on my travels, and who, I can assure you, you will find well deserves your regard and admiration."
Camaralzaman was much surprised at hearing the king, who he never suspected of being a woman in disguise, asserting their acquaintance, for he felt sure he had never seen her before. However, he received all the praises bestowed on him with becoming modesty, and prostrating himself said,
"Sire, I cannot find words in which to thank your majesty for the great honor conferred on me. I can but assure you that I will do all in my power to prove myself worthy of it."
On leaving the council, the prince was conducted to a splendid house which had been prepared for him, where he found a full establishment and well-filled stables at his orders. On entering his study, his steward presented him with a coffer filled with gold pieces for his current expenses. He felt more and more puzzled by such good fortune, and little guessed that the Princess of China was the cause of it. After a few days, the Princess Badoura promoted Camaralzaman to the post of Grand Treasurer, an office which he filled with so much integrity and benevolence as to win universal esteem. He would now have thought himself the happiest of men, had it not been for that separation, which he never ceased to bewail. He had no clue to the mystery of his present position, for the princess, out of compliment to the old king, had taken his name, and was generally known as King Armanos the Younger, few people remembering that on her first arrival she went by another name. At length, the princess felt that the time had come to put an end to her own and the prince's suspense, and having arranged all her plans with the Princess Hayatel Nefes, she informed Camaralzaman that she wished his advice on some important business, and, to avoid being disturbed, desired him to come to the palace that evening. The prince was punctual, and was received in the private apartment when, having ordered her attendants to withdraw, the princess took from a small box the talisman, and handing it to Qamar al-Zaman, said,
"Not long ago, an astrologer gave me this talisman. As you are universally well informed, you can perhaps tell me what is its use."
Qamar al-Zaman took the talisman and, holding it to the light, cried with surprise,
"Sire, you ask me the use of this talisman? Alas, hitherto it has been only a source of misfortune to me, being the cause of my separation from the one I love best on earth. The story is so sad and strange that I am sure your majesty will be touched by it if you will permit me to tell it you."
"I will hear it some other time," replied the princess. "Meanwhile, I fancy it is not quite unknown to me. Wait here for me. I will return shortly."
So saying, she retired to another room, where she hastily changed her masculine attire for that of a woman, and, after putting on the girdle she wore the day they parted, returned to Qamar al-Zaman. The prince recognized her at once, and, embracing her with the utmost tenderness, cried,
"Ah, how can I thank the king for this delightful surprise?"
"Do not expect ever to see the king again," said the princess, as she wiped the tears of joy from her eyes. "In me, you see the king. Let us sit down, and I will tell you all about it."
She then gave a full account of all her adventures since their parting, and dwelt much on the charms and noble disposition of the Princess Hayat al-Nefis, to whose friendly assistance she owed so much. When she had done, she asked to hear the prince's story, and in this manner they spent most of the night. Next morning the princess resumed her woman's clothes, and as soon as she was ready she desired the chief eunuch to beg King Armanos to come to her apartments. When the king arrived, great was his surprise at finding a strange lady in company of the grand treasurer, who had no actual right to enter the private apartments. Seating himself, he asked for the king.
"Sire," said the princess, "yesterday I was the king. Today I am only the princess of China, and wife to the real Prince Qamar al-Zaman, son of King Shahzaman, and I trust that when your majesty shall have heard our story, you will not condemn the innocent deception I have been obliged to practice."
The king consented to listen, and did so with marked surprise. At the close of her narrative, the princess said,
"Sire, as our religion allows a man to have more than one wife, I would beg your majesty to give your daughter, the Prince Hayat al-Nefis, in marriage to Prince Qamar al-Zaman. I gladly yield to her the precedence and title of queen, in recognition of the debt of gratitude which I owe her."
King Armanos heard the princess with surprise and admiration. Then, turning to Qamar al-Zaman, he said,
"My son, as your wife, the Princess Badoura, whom I have hitherto looked on as my son-in-law, consents to share your hand and affections with my daughter, I have only to ask if this marriage is agreeable to you, and if you will consent to accept the crown which the Princess Badoura deserves to wear all her life, but which she prefers to resign for love of you."
"Sire," replied Qamar al-Zaman, "I can refuse your majesty nothing."
Accordingly, Qamar al-Zaman was duly proclaimed king, and as duly married with all pomp to the Princess Hayat al-Nefis, with whose beauty, talents, and affections he had every reason to be pleased. The two queens lived in true sisterly harmony together, and after a time each presented King Qamar al-Zaman with a son, whose births were celebrated throughout the kingdom with the utmost rejoicing. Nureddin and the Fair Persian. Balsora was the capital of a kingdom long tributary to the caliph. During the time of the caliph Harun al-Rashid, the king of Balsora, who was his cousin, was called Zinebi. Not thinking one vizier enough for the administration of his estates, he had two, named Kakan and Saui. Kakan was kind, generous, and liberal, and took pleasure in obliging, as far as in him lay, those who had business with him. Throughout the entire kingdom, there was no one who did not esteem and praise him as he deserved. Saui was quite a different character, and repelled everyone with whom he came in contact. He was always gloomy, and, in spite of his great riches, so miserly that he denied himself even the necessaries of life. What made him particularly detested was the great aversion he had to Kakan, of whom he never ceased to speak evil to the king. One day, while the king amused himself talking with his two viziers and other members of the council, the conversation turned on female slaves. While some declared that it sufficed for a slave to be beautiful, others, and Kakan was among the number, maintained that beauty alone was not enough, but that it must be accompanied by wit, wisdom, modesty, and, if possible, knowledge. The king not only declared himself to be of this opinion, but charged Kakan to procure him a slave who should fulfill all these conditions. Sa'ui, who had been of the opposite side, and was jealous of the honor done to Kakan, said,
"Sire, it will be very difficult to find a slave as accomplished as your majesty desires, and if she is to be found, she will be cheap if she cost less than 10,000 gold pieces."
"Sa'ui," answered the king, "you seem to find that a very great sum. For you it may be so, but not for me."
And forthwith he ordered his grand treasurer, who was present, to send 10,000 gold pieces to Kakan for the purchase of the slave. As soon, then, as Kakan returned home, he sent for the dealers in female slaves and charged them directly they had found such a one as he described to inform him. They promised to do their utmost, and no day passed that they did not bring a slave for his inspection. But none was found without some defect. At length, early one morning, while Kakan was on his way to the king's palace, a dealer, throwing himself in his way, announced eagerly that a Persian merchant, arrived late the previous evening, had a slave to sell whose wit and wisdom were equal to her incomparable beauty. Kakan, overjoyed at this news, gave orders that the slave should be brought for his inspection on his return from the palace. The dealer appeared at the appointed hour. Kakan found the slave beautiful beyond his expectations and immediately gave her the name of the Fair Persian. Being a man of great wisdom and learning, he perceived in the short conversation he had with her that he would seek in vain another slave to surpass her in any of the qualities required by the king, and therefore asked the dealer what price the merchant put upon her.
"Sir," was the answer, "for less than 10,000 gold pieces he will not let her go. He declares that, what with masters for her instruction and for bodily exercises, not to speak of clothing and nourishment, he has already spent that sum upon her. She is in every way fit to be the slave of a king. She plays every musical instrument, she sings, she dances, she makes verses. In fact, there is no accomplishment in which she does not excel."
Kakan, who was better able to judge of her merits than the dealer, wishing to bring the matter to a conclusion, sent for the merchant, and said to him,
"It is not for myself that I wish to buy your slave, but for the king. Her price, however, is too high."
"Sir," replied the merchant, "I should esteem it an honor to present her to his majesty. Did it become a merchant to do such a thing? I ask no more than the sum it has cost me to make her such as she is."
Kakan, not wishing to bargain, immediately had the sum counted out and given to the merchant, who before withdrawing said,
"Sir, as she is destined for the king, I would have you observe that she is extremely tired with the long journey, and before presenting her to his majesty, you would do well to keep her a fortnight in your own house, and to see that a little care is bestowed upon her. The sun has tanned her complexion, but when she has been two or three times to the bath, and is fittingly dressed, you will see how much her beauty will be increased."
Kakan thanked the merchant for his advice and determined to follow it. He gave the beautiful Persian an apartment near to that of his wife, whom he charged to treat her as befitting a lady destined for the king, and to order for her the most magnificent garments. Before bidding adieu to the fair Persian, he said to her,
"No happiness can be greater than what I have procured for you. Judge for yourself, you now belong to the king. I have, however, to warn you of one thing. I have a son who, though not wanting in sense, is young, foolish, and headstrong, and I charge you to keep him at a distance."
The Persian thanked him for his advice and promised to profit by it. Nureddin, for so the vizier's son was named, went freely in and out of his mother's apartments. He was young, well-made, and agreeable, and had the gift of charming all with whom he came in contact. As soon as he saw the beautiful Persian, though aware that she was destined for the king, he let himself be carried away by her charms, and determined at once to use every means in his power to retain her for himself. The Persian was equally captivated by Nureddin, and said to herself,
"The vizier does me too great honor in buying me for the king. I should esteem myself very happy if he would give me to his son."
Nureddin availed himself of every opportunity to gaze upon her beauty, to talk and laugh with her, and never would have left her side if his mother had not forced him. Some time having elapsed, on account of the long journey since the beautiful Persian had been to the bath, 5 or 6 days after her purchase, the vizier's wife gave orders that the bath should be heated for her, and that her own female slaves should attend her there, and afterwards should array her in a magnificent dress that had been prepared for her. Her toilet completed, the beautiful Persian came to present herself to the vizier's wife, who hardly recognized her, so greatly was her beauty increased. Kissing her hand, the beautiful slave said,
"Madam, I do not know how you find me in this dress that you have had prepared for me. Your women assure me that it suits me so well that they hardly knew me. If it is the truth they tell me, and not flattery, it is to you I owe the transformation."
"My daughter," answered the vizier's wife, "they do not flatter you. I myself hardly recognized you. The improvement is not due to the dress alone, but largely to the beautifying effects of the bath. I am so struck by its results that I would try it on myself."
Acting forthwith on this decision, she ordered 2 little slaves during her absence to watch over the beautiful Persian and not to allow Nureddin to enter should he come. She had no sooner gone than he arrived, and not finding his mother in her apartment, would have sought her in that of the Persian. The 2 little slaves barred the entrance, saying that his mother had given orders that he was not to be admitted. Taking each by an arm, he put them out of the anteroom and shut the door. Then they rushed to the bath, informing their mistress with shrieks and tears that Nureddin had driven them away by force and gone in. This news caused great consternation to the lady, who, dressing herself as quickly as possible, hastened to the apartment of the fair Persian to find that Nureddin had already gone out. Much astonished to see the vizier's wife enter in tears, the Persian asked what misfortune had happened.
"What?" exclaimed the lady. "You ask me that, knowing that my son Nureddin has been alone with you?"
"But, madam," inquired the Persian, "what harm is there in that?"
"How? Has my husband not told you that you are destined for the king?"
"Certainly, but Nureddin has just been to tell me that his father has changed his mind and has bestowed me upon him. I believed him, and so great is my affection for Nureddin, that I would willingly pass my life with him."
"Would to heavens," exclaimed the wife of the vizier, "that what you say were true. But Nureddin has deceived you, and his father will sacrifice him in vengeance for the wrong he has done."
So saying, she wept bitterly, and all her slaves wept with her. Khacan, entering shortly after this, was much astonished to find his wife and her slaves in tears, and the beautiful Persian greatly perturbed. He inquired the cause, but for some time no answer was forthcoming. When his wife was at length sufficiently calm to inform him of what had happened, his rage and mortification knew no bounds. Wringing his hands and rending his beard, he exclaimed,
"Wretched son, thou destroyest not only thyself, but thy father. The king will shed not only thy blood, but mine."
His wife tried to console him, saying,
"Do not torment thyself. With the sale of my jewels, I will obtain 10,000 gold pieces, and with this sum you will buy another slave."
"Do not suppose," replied her husband, "that it is the loss of the money that affects me. My honor is at stake, and that is more precious to me than all my wealth.
You know that Saui is my mortal enemy. He will relate all this to the king, and you will see the consequences that will ensue.
My lord, said his wife, I am quite aware of Saui's baseness, and that he is capable of playing you this malicious trick. But how can he, or anyone else, know what takes place in this house? Even if you are suspected and the king accuses you, you have only to say that, after examining the slave, you did not find her worthy of his majesty. Reassure yourself, and send to the dealers, saying that you are not satisfied, and wish them to find you another slave.
This advice appearing reasonable, Kakan decided to follow it. But his wrath against his son did not abate. Nureddin dared not appear all that day, and fearing to take refuge with his usual associates in case his father should seek him there, he spent the day in a secluded garden where he was not known. He did not return home till after his father had gone to bed, and went out early next morning before the vizier awoke, and these precautions he kept up during an entire month. His mother, though knowing very well that he returned to the house every evening, dared not ask her husband to pardon him. At length, she took courage and said,
My lord, I know that a son could not act more basely towards his father than Nureddin has done towards you, but after all, will you now pardon him? Do you not consider the harm you may be doing yourself, and fear that malicious people, seeking the cause of your estrangement, may guess the real one?
Madam, replied the vizier, what you say is very just, but I cannot pardon Nureddin before I have mortified him as he deserves.
He will be sufficiently punished, answered the lady, if you do as I suggest. In the evening, when he returns home, lie in wait for him and pretend that you will slay him. I will come to his aid, and while pointing out that you only yield his life at my supplications, you can force him to take the beautiful Persian on any conditions you please.